WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
If you think you knew Paul Theroux from his many books on travel, like The Great Railway Bazaar, and his novels like Mosquito Coast, you might want to think again. In his new book, My Other Life, Theroux has created an interesting challenge for readers. The novel is about a writer named Paul Theroux, who, like the real writer, has lived in Africa, Singapore, England, and America. In writing My Other Life, Theroux says he was entirely driven by his alter ego's murmurs of, "What if?" He says it's the writer's privilege to keep some facades intact and to use his own face in the masquerade. I spoke to Paul Theroux in front of an audience at the Free Library of Philadelphia in October, and I asked him to tell me about the character, Paul Theroux.
Fiction gives us the second chance that life denies us. Life denies us all a chance of going back. If you want to do something, you want to fantasize about having married someone else or quit a job or meeting a psychopath or, I don't know, lying to your psychiatrist or falling in love or whatever it is, that the writer can vicariously live out that fantasy. And I think that I've been told that the character in this book is faintly unpleasant.
I've heard worse than that.
Devious. Well, I think I was very averse to putting myself in a grand light, you know, to making myself look too good, because then it would look as though I was making myself better than I am. But I think probably I prefer to look worse than better.
Well, it's interesting in the book because Paul Theroux, the character, meets people who have read his book, but they don't know that he is Paul Theroux. And it got me wondering how you think about your readers, if you do at all.
I think about my readers a lot. I was just in Africa. I was on the Zambezi, on the upper Zambezi, in Zambia. It goes, if you look at a map of Africa, it's south central. It starts way on the left-hand side near Angola, and it goes out to the Indian Ocean. And there was a man who never helped. There were four of us in canoes going down, threading between the hippos. Because hippos are very territorial. You have to be very careful not to upset them. If you do, they lower themselves in the water, and they come up under your boat, and they might take a bite out of your boat. Crocodiles are not a problem. Snakes, not a serious problem. Mosquitoes, slight problem. People, no problem. The only problem are hippos, hippopotami. So if remember that. And particularly, they can stay down for 7 minutes. So the thing is to look at the river and make sure that you've been looking at it for 7 minutes, because if it's 5 minutes, there might still be one down there, and when you're going across, he'll come up. So anyway, there was a man that never helped us with our packing up. In the morning, we'd set off just at dawn or just before dawn to get to a certain point before the heat of the day. Then we'd stop for about 3 hours or 4 hours, then set off again in the afternoon. This man was never, and I went over him one day and I was thinking, this guy is always sitting under this tree. I was thinking, writing notes, but not helping, just the unhelpful person. And it's terrible to make an enemy of anyone on a camping trip. So, as I say, he was with his wife. He was an ophthalmologist, though that's not relevant in this context. I went to him one day and I thought, I'm going to go over and I say, why don't you help? You know, do us a favor, do yourself a favor. This stuff's heavy, we've got to pack the boats, canoes, and go off. I went over, and he had a book in his hand. It was one of my books. It was Ozone, big fat book. He was, you know, a third of the way through. And I said, what are you doing? You're reading a book? I said, I wrote that book. He said, are you Paul Theroux? I said, yeah, that's me. He suddenly said, I thought, well, if you're not going to help us, that's okay. You can, you've chosen a fairly sensible thing. Okay, that was one. And there was another one. You know, I started life as a pre-medical student. I have a science degree, and I wanted to be a doctor. And when I joined the Peace Corps in 1963 and went to Africa, I really did want to be a doctor. Anyway, at another place called Lukulu on the Zambezi, this was the upper Zambezi, I went to a hospital in a leper colony, and I met a doctor. He was Dutch, and I said, I'd like to see your hospital. Well, the problem there is AIDS. He saw an HIV or AIDS patient every day, a new one every day. There's a very, very high rate of infection. Unfortunately, that's Zambia. It's the same in Zimbabwe and Mozambique and Malawi, unfortunately. And I said, I wanted to be you. I wanted to be you. And he said, well, so what did you choose to do? I said, well, I became a writer because I thought I can't go to medical school and be a writer. I can only choose one thing. I'm not Chekhov. Chekhov managed to go to Eastern Siberia, Sakhalin, as a traveler and a writer and a doctor. He was a good doctor and a good writer. Your near neighbor, William Carlos Williams, was a great gynecologist, obstetrician. He wrote great poetry. But it's a lot of few people that they can do both things well. Anyway, he said, so you're a writer, what do you write? I said, I write travel books, novels, and whatnot. And he said, do I know your name? And I told him. He said, I'm reading one of your books. He said, I'd love to do what you're doing. And I said, well, too bad we can't swap lives. He was reading the Dutch edition of The Happy Isles of Oceania. It had been given to him by 3 years before by members of his medical academy. And it said, the inscription, it said, this book by an adventurer to another adventurer, Peter Klabers, you know, have a good time in Africa. And when a book is written in Dutch, it's really thick. It looks like a monumental tome. So here's two examples. You say, do I meet my readers? There's two. In Africa, in the most unlikely places. And so I do meet them occasionally in odd circumstances.
Well, I wonder if there's any hesitancy, because two things that you've said, one in a magazine interview, I have never met a writer who was greater than his work. And in this novel, you write, most writers are balder and smaller than you expect. This idea that somehow when they meet you, you will disappoint them.
I think it is disappointing to meet writers, yeah. And when you think of the writers, you know, Alexander Pope was about 4.5 feet tall. Picasso was only about 5 feet tall. Just little, you know, bundle of energy. I'm not saying that if you're small, there's something wrong, but most people think a man doing a monumental painting, Guernica, huge painting, he's going to be a big, robust, but it's just a very tiny, energetic person. So, yeah, I think it's kind of disappointing to meet writers, and that there seems to be no connection between the physical writer and the work. Of course there is. We know there is. Big, tall people don't become writers. They don't need to become writers. They have a command of the world. They sort of own the world. They can. Everyone will, you know, do what they say. But a writer is someone who's fantasizing about giving orders. He's going home, he's writing about being tall.
Little Napoleons.
Yeah, I mean, no. Writers have to have problems. They wouldn't become writers if they didn't. Normal people don't become writers. Dysfunctional, lonely, reclusive. People who are bad at sports. People who don't fit in. It sounds funny, but I think it's true. Why would anyone who is normal and well-balanced ever become a writer? Or become creative? It's the people who are filling some void. Who become writers. I come from a very large family. And that can make a person a writer. Seven children. I'm just one of seven children. I think that's a factor. I do.
Did you have to leave this country, though, and go to Africa to be a writer? Join the Peace Corps, which you did?
I didn't have to, but it helped. I wanted to feel that I was doing something constructive. But anyone who goes to another country is a student, not a teacher. You're a child. You don't speak the language. It takes a lot of humility to go to another country because you're at sea. You can't. That's why people stay in expensive hotels, I think, because it's so intimidating not to. In a good hotel, they say, well, everything's going to be all right. We'll look after you. But if you're away from the hotel, you're in the bush, you have to learn the language and find out how it works. That did make me a writer. It made me self-sufficient. But the most important thing, I suppose, that made me a writer was that I was away from my family. No one was asking me, what are you going to be? What are you going to be? What are you going to do? I would have said, I'm going to be a writer. What are you going to write? And I'd say, I don't know. About you, I guess. I'd say, what? I'm going to write something. And then they'd say, well, who's going to pay you? How are you going to get money? What are you going to do? They would ask me questions. Well, you should never be around people who ask you questions to which you have no answers. I mean, I think that might be a good lesson in life. If anyone's going to ask you a question that you don't have the answers to, stay away from that person. And if you're young, it's really helpful to not to have to answer those questions. No one asked me any questions.
Had anyone in your family ever been a writer? Was this just a totally alien occupation as far as your family was concerned?
No, I came from an educated family that understood, you know, literate educated family. And my grandfather wrote poetry and was a kind of self-publishing. No one had published a book. That was a mystery. But it was a mystery to most people. I mean, I think it's only recently that there's been a proliferation of writers. I don't know where you begin. I thought, write a book and somehow it would get published. I didn't know the modus operandi. It was a bit of a mystery, but I think it's a mystery to most people, even to highly educated people, even to, you know, people in universities ask me, how did you get your book published? Sometimes they say, how can I get my book published? And I think, well, you're a fairly intelligent person. You work it out, figure it out. But the most important thing was that I was self-sufficient. I was on my own. I had elbow room. And I was in a culture that hadn't been studied much. So I had to I had to be small, grateful, humble, and learn about it. And it was wonderful. I learned another language. I remember asking an old man, this was in Africa, I learned Chinyanja, and I said, we were talking about what would now be called options, what are you going to do? And he said, what are you going to do? Something like that. And he was an old man. He addressed me as Father Bambo. They didn't use the word Bwana. Bwana was a big master. But as between two people, all this man was probably in his late 60s, born about the turn of the century, then wise man. He was addressed me as Bambo, Father. And I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, Ukaipa nkope tziwa nyimbo. If your face is ugly, learn to sing.
And here you are.
Yeah. It was, you know, lateral thinking. You'll figure it out. So, yeah. Actually, on this last trip, I wrote down some more proverbs. I don't mean to bore you with them, but there was a great one that someone told me, and they told me laughing. They said we were talking about just wisdom. Just you know, I was talking about my mother, and this man said, "Makundi mako usamoana kuchepa mwendo." Your mother's your mother, even if she has a small leg, even if one of her legs is too small. Like the Irish say, my mother, drunk or sober, she's right. Another one was, matako ala bili tabuli kuchumbana. Two buttocks cannot avoid friction. So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, there was a lot of earthy wisdom. And when I understood that, I thought, I can write about this.
Well, one of the things that I think you really are known for, and I certainly appreciate, is your ability to write dialogue and to be able to express someone through that kind of dialogue. And having lived all over the world, I don't know how many languages you speak or parts of languages that you speak, but are you an eavesdropper? Are you tuned into people's cadences, how they speak, as a kind of fingerprint for who they are?
Yes, I think I try to be the eavesdropper, but also it requires your close attention. I was in I was in Minneapolis the other day, and funny that you should say that. But I saw a man with a little badge that said Uptown Brown, and I said, that's an amazing. I said, do you mind if I ask you how you got that name? And he said, well, they used to call me Downtown Brown. When I played for the Peoria Falcons, and I used to shoot from downtown. But the older I got, the better I used to be. Now I'm Uptown Brown.
Oh, that's great.
So it's also writing things down. It's a nice little, I'll never use it. I thought, I'm going to sell that name to, what's his name? Elmore Leonard. Elmore Leonard's the sort of person, you could imagine him calling a book Uptown Brown.
Yeah.
Writer Paul Theroux, his new book, a novel, is called My Other Life. We spoke at the Free Library of Philadelphia in October. This is Fresh Air.